Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, sports betting is even more prevalent than we already think. And we can take a lesson from a longtime blacksmith who says persistence is key. But first this morning, our Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
When you have on election day the appearance of an outcome that one person won and the other person lost, only to have it reversed days later, the more people start to question it. It is just human nature.
Voting is so convenient in Arizona. 86% of voters vote by mail-in ballot. I don't think people are looking for less convenience. I think they're looking for more convenience.
I am that kid that worked in the fields.
What we're doing is we're wiping away my father-in-law, my grandfather, all my families.
What about police officers, firemen, teachers, plumbers?
I think we can't take anything off the table, but I do recognize that the gas tax is a very complicated issue. And I think what might provide more relief, and I think our senators are looking at this, is some federal gas tax relief.
We should not be going to war. There's no reason why we couldn't have worked this out. There's no reason why we should be going to war for other countries, whether it's the Gulf Coast countries or Israel. This is not our fight, and we need to stop what we're doing right now.
All right, here to talk about the repeal of Cesar Chavez Day in Arizona, what politicians are trying to do to address sky-high gas prices, and a failed Republican attempt to dismantle a national monument near the Grand Canyon are Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Good morning, Barrett.
Good morning, Radioland.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Good morning to you both. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with voting by mail in particular here. There's a lot kind of happening on this front this week. We had a executive order come down from the president, a sweeping one that would kind of federalize mail-in voting nationwide. It would create a national list of eligible voters. It would restrict who gets mail-in ballots. This was immediately challenged by Democratic groups. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays says she'll sue about it. Barrett, as we know, the vast majority of voters in our state vote by mail. I think it's more than 80%. Why do Republicans target mail-in voting this way?
Well, first, let me say I'm a Republican that's old enough to remember when Republicans really were against some sort of national ID so that there would be some national database that we would be in. It seems ridiculous to me that should not be Republican orthodoxy. So that's number one. Number two, as one of your voices earlier said, you know, more than 80% of people vote by mail here in Arizona, vote early. We love voting early. Republicans are the ones who instituted this, and it was one of the best sort of election reforms that we have done in Arizona's history.
We were a trailblazer in that.
Absolutely. We've been doing it for over a generation. It is safe and secure. And I don't care what they do in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or wherever else, but in Arizona, it is a safe and secure form of voting. And I say hands off our ballots.
So, Tony, we've been seeing these attacks on mail-in voting from Republicans for many years now. Every time this happens and hits the headlines or we have an executive order like we did this week, what are Democrats thinking?
Well, one thing I always think about is the fact that for years, Democrats would struggle with vote by mail. Vote by mail was something that helped Republicans win elections in our state. Mm. Until conspiracy theorists started to convince Republican voters that vote by mail was something that shouldn't be happening. And that's really what this is about, is that now these people have convinced, you know, MAGA types have convinced large chunks of a small group of Republicans that there's some fraud that can come out of this that doesn't happen. And they want to restrict voting and make it harder to vote. And we don't need to do a poll. We don't need to speculate. We know that a vast, vast majority of Arizonans of both political parties vote by mail. And I think part of the reason why this happens so much is that there is an economy that's built around this type of election denialism, where there are groups that make money from donors saying that they're going to stop this type of fraud. They're going to you know, find out what happened in the 2020 election and all this kind of stuff. And so it's just a beast that feeds itself. But from the president's perspective, it seems much more nefarious than that. It seems like this is absolutely 100% an attempt, an illegal attempt to try to influence who gets to vote in elections.
Yeah, Tony, I'll disagree with you in one place. It's not an economy that's built around this. It's a grift that is built around this.
Yeah, it's a grift. That's right.
You know, people are making money sowing doubt about many things in the election world, but especially mail-in voting. And there is in Arizona, again, I'm not vouching for Pennsylvania or any other state, but in Arizona, it is safe and secure, and that's just the way it is. And again, you know, 80%+ of people use it because it's so convenient to sit at your kitchen table and fill out a ballot.
Especially when you have long ballots like we have in Arizona with all these ballot initiatives that
the Republican legislators
are jumping on.
It's not that. It's the judges. There's 40 judges on the ballot.
Well, we'll see. This time around it might be both. But I wonder this too, because there's also this debate about the late earlies, right? The people dropping off those early ballots on election day, which I will totally cop to having done before.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I used to be part of the problem. There's no doubt about that.
And it slows down election results and makes it harder for that process to happen quickly. And there's a lot of efforts locally to try to speed that up. What do you both make of those? Because in general, elections officials will say it's not any slower than it used to be. We're just having closer elections.
Right. And honestly, I don't even have a problem with your ballot has to be in by the Friday before the election, wherever some of the deadlines are. I don't have a problem with that. Or if you want to drop off your ballot at a poll, that you have to show your ID or the signature. Those kinds of things, actually, I don't have a problem with, because we live in a society, right or wrong, where we want answers immediately. And so when the polls close at 7 and that first release is at 8, why is it that we're counting, you know, 4 days later? It's because, Lauren, you and I were part of the problem. I want to get all the mail. I want to, you know, make sure there's no October surprise. So I'm going to fill out my ballot late in the voting period, and then just drop it off on election day. And that
or maybe
takes a
you're
long
undecided.
Time.
Right? Yeah, or maybe there was news that some people hold on to their ballot because they haven't made up their mind yet.
Yeah.
And they know that they have extra time. I'm someone who thinks that the majority of the people who care about getting results on election night are people who sit and talk into microphones about elections and the kind of people who get paid to work in elections. I think that obviously many people have taken advantage of the amount of time it does take to accurately count these votes to sow doubt. And then they're saying, look at how – you know, they're like, why is it taking so long? It must be that they're cheating. And then they go, look, all these people think that there's cheating because it took so long.
But does it undermine voter confidence, you think, a little bit?
I think it's a vulnerability in the sense that people who want to undermine voter confidence use it to undermine voter confidence.
And remember, no matter what the deadline is, people will wait till the deadline. If the deadline is election day, they're going to wait that. If the deadline is Friday before, they will get it. They will meet the deadline. They'll do it on Thursday. Or they'll, you know, if the deadline is Tuesday, they'll do it on Monday.
So you don't think moving up that deadline would disenfranchise voters?
No, I don't think so at all.
What do you think, Tony?
I think it probably would. I think that at least in the period immediately when they change it, it will. And so, again, it just comes down to sort of like what it is that we're prioritizing.
All right. I want to talk about another big story this week. Arizona lawmakers voted almost unanimously to repeal Cesar Chavez Day, and our state governor Hobbs signed that legislation this week. And I say almost unanimously because there was a Democratic effort on the floor to not just repeal but rename it Farm Workers Day. Some really emotional testimony from some lawmakers that we heard at the beginning of the show. And I wonder, Barrett, like, what do you make of that argument for a Farm Workers Day and the Republican response to it, which we also heard, which was sort of like, you know, we don't honor every other profession.
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, we don't have, Cook's Day or, National Transportation Workers Day. We don't do those kinds of things. And I think Cesar Chavez, now we look at him a little differently. Up until just a couple of weeks ago, he was looked at as sort of a national hero and someone who led the civil rights fight. Now, of course, we do look at him a little differently, and it's wise to take him off of the name of schools and streets and state holidays and things like that. Cities have started taking away that holiday, and I think that's the right thing to do. I don't think we need to rename Farm Workers Day because, again, we don't have, you know, I don't think we should give this one group of people more honor than a lot of other hardworking people, plumbers. We don't have Plumbers Day.
What do you think about that, Tony, and this argument that, you know, you can erase Cesar Chavez's name in light of these allegations and what's come forth in the last couple of weeks here, but we should still honor the movement that he founded, started, and other people were involved in?
I think for a lot of people, that is what Cesar Chavez did represented, especially in Arizona, where so much of that history took place. It is about these farm workers and just, you know, the total abuse of civil rights, you know, that was taking place before the movement. You know, I definitely understand it. And I think that, you know, there's a difference where at the cities they're saying, okay, well, we need to then – we're going to name it Farm Workers Day. At the state, the Republicans are never going to get behind that. Mm. And so – but I think it was a courageous, you know, effort by those who wanted to make the argument that we should be honoring this civil rights legacy.
And I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I was going to say, but, you know, I think that when it comes down to it though – almost everybody voted and they said, hey, this is a person that we should not be honoring, that our history, you know, we put names on buildings and we put government statues and these things to honor people. Sometimes you get new information and you need to just be like, hey, this isn't the kind of person we want to honor anymore. And I do think that like how quickly that worked and how quickly Democrats sort of jumped on that to say, right, like, hey, this is a hero, you know, in my history, but we need to do something about it. I think that – I wish we would do that a little more with some of these, you know, Civil War type figures, but that's a whole nother matter.
And
that
the good work that he did does live on, right? And the work, the civil rights work that happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s in that movement does live on. And there are farm workers now have rights that they didn't have back in the 30s, 40s, 50s. So the legacy, if you, of that work still lives on. Obviously, we don't need to lionize him anymore.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there for now. We're going to head to a break and we'll be back with more of our Friday newscap right after this. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I am Lauren Gilger and we're back now with more of our Friday newscap. I'm joined this morning by Democratic strategist Tony Connie and Barrett Marson of Marson Media. And guys, let's talk about gas prices. They have just shot up since the president began this war in Iran alongside Israel. I think it cost me $70 to fill up my tank this morning. I, you know, cringed a little bit.
Well, that Hummer that you own, maybe you should
get
a Prius
or something.
It's not a Hummer,
I swear. I did have a Prius for a long time. Doesn't fit the kids. All right. Yeah. So, I mean, Tony, you've got Senator Ruben Gallego doing press conferences at a gas station. You know, calling for the suspension of the gas tax. We've got, you know, the IRS being called for to change its policies on business use of automobiles. Governor Hobbs, some Republican leaders, too, say they pushed the EPA to issue this fuel waiver to keep gas prices lower and kind of allow us to not have to use that winter blend that costs a little more. So, like, a lot of political moves trying to be made here. I wonder, like, how much can politicians really do about this?
Well, these are all efforts to make a difference on the margins for people who are struggling, because people are struggling with these high gas prices. It all comes, of course, from, I don't know, like a fraternity planning a war in Iran. I don't understand that they didn't expect this to happen.
He expected worse, he said. So this is going better than he expected, apparently.
It's reckless. And of course, you know, this also puts a real, you know, highlight on the fact that we are so dependent on energy, on fossil fuels. And this is, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after the administration wiped out all kinds of infrastructure funding that was supposed to go for electric vehicles. And now you're seeing people being like, boy, I guess I need an electric vehicle. Every time there's a big spike in gas like this, more people take public transit, more people go to electric vehicles. And this is an example of, like, this is out of our control. You can't in America drill your way out of this specific situation that we're dealing with right now.
Well, it's hopefully a temporary situation, you know, by temporary, it's months, hopefully, and not many years. But I will say, some of the hand-wringing from Democrats, where was this in 2022 when gas was $5 a gallon here in Arizona? You know, we were told that nothing to worry about. And so it's a little bit hypocritical.
I don't know if you were told nothing to worry about.
Well,
I think you were told The difference was whether or not
we were lied to
in
by,
that situation.
We were lied to by Democrats that don't even think about it. You're doing much better than.
Well, I will say there was a trend among Democrats to kind of hold up a chart to say, no, you're doing well, which is very interesting to see Republicans do that again in this cycle. But
right.
There wasn't a war that caused this problem.
Right. Yeah, it was just bad policy.
We can see the results of this, you know, very directly from the war. Right. Yeah. And but I wonder, though, because President Trump did run so much on, you know, these pocketbook issues like cost of living issues, saying we will bring down gas prices. It costs too much at the grocery store. None of those things have really happened at this point.
Well, at this point, certainly. And yeah, you know, Donald Trump, I think it's inarguable that Donald Trump won the White House because of economic issues. And now he is falling into the exact same trap that Joe Biden was in and then Kamala Harris, where, hey, it's just temporary pain. Don't worry about it, people. You're paying $5 a gallon. Don't worry about it. I'm not worried about it, says the man who has free transportation. So, you know, I do think this is a problem for Trump and for Republicans, every Republican on the ballot, just as it was 2 years ago. Yeah. It was a problem for Democrats.
Yeah.
And, you know, Democrats lost a significant amount of elections because of affordability. It is still an issue, and it is – maybe arguably a greater issue now because, you know, gas prices are shot up like the Artemis rocket and they will not come down that quickly for sure. And, you know, to the point earlier about like the gas tax and things, the gas tax is 18 cents a gallon. Yeah. Significant, of course. However, we see 18 cent increases in a day. So you could wipe out 1 day or 2 days worth of increases with the gas tax. That's not a lot. That's not providing much relief. And not only that, but you're also robbing, you know, road repair and things like that.
Yeah. Tony, is this a big opening for Democrats? And how do they use this to not just talk about, right, like what the things that we're all mad about, but like you have to come forth with an idea, with ideas to, you know, actually address those cost of living issues, you know, before something.
Yeah, I think that's the real challenge for Democrats is that Democrats have to be presenting an alternative vision. And of course, one of the alternative visions is just like rational foreign policy that won't lead to this kind of a thing. But I do think this is a big opening, especially when it comes to the voters who typically would not have voted for a Republican president in this last cycle but switched over for the first time. Mm-hmm. There was a big chunk of those voters. One of the major reasons they did it is because they thought, oh man, these Democrats have said they would do things and they weren't able to accomplish it. And then we're going to give it to Trump because he's just going to go and do it. And they're seeing Trump just like, you know, break all kinds of laws and rules to get things done, but not to do anything related to their pocketbook issues. And I think that it's going to put a lot of credibility. And one of the problems here is that the Republicans, particularly in Arizona, that are running for all of these offices, are so closely tied with the president because mm-hmm. they can't win a primary without him that it is a real challenge for themselves to distance themselves from him in a way that typically you know, the party in control might do in an election like this.
There was a real chance for realignment after 2024 of, you know, Hispanic voters and things like that. The Republicans really could take advantage of increased Hispanic participation voting for Republicans. That might have been just a blip on the radar. That mm-hmm. might have just been transitory.
You think because of these economic issues?
Because of the economic right. issues, because of some of the immigration issues. And there didn't appear to be an attempt to, we've got you, let's hold you.
What do you think about that, Tony?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the big lessons that I've learned doing this work in this – and, you know, I was on the Biden campaign in 2020 in Arizona – is that we treated those voters, Latino voters particularly, as a persuasion group. They were a group that you were not thinking, oh, because of their demographics, they're going to vote for Democrats. Mm. And we were very explicit about that. And one of the things that I saw is that it seemed very quickly that some of these Republicans did make the switch to thinking like, oh, we did better with Latinos than we did before. They're going to be with us for whatever reason. And that's not the case. This yeah. is a large, growing demographic of voters that are persuadable. They're the ones you have to convince. You can't just make an assumption because of where they live or what they look like that they're going to vote for one of the political parties.
I want to take a minute and talk about Republican Representative Walt Blackmun in a little bit of a turn here. This is a challenge to him we're seeing happen right now. Steve Slayton, who owns the Trumped Up store, the Trump store in Sholo, is challenging Blackmun. And these two, you know, have a long history that involves allegations of stolen valor, and there's a defamation lawsuit, I know. But I want to talk about why Slayton is challenging Blackmun here, because this has to do with campaign finance reports. He says that Blackmun should be disqualified disqualified from being on the ballot because he has $168,000 in unpaid penalties because he didn't file campaign finance reports for years here. Tony, tell me what you make of this.
Well, I think that we have campaign finance reports so the public can see who is giving money to candidates. That is the reason that it exists. You want to know what they're spending their money on, that kind of stuff. And so there is a long history in our state of certain people, and it's of both political parties, choosing not to file these reports in some ways intentionally, I think, it looks like, because they just don't want people to see who their donors are until the election or something. And I think that's a serious issue, and there is no enforcement of the fines that come out of it. What happens typically is that a candidate will just close that committee and open a new one.
Wow.
You know, I know that there's examples of – on the Democrat side, like Alma Hernandez. She's someone who's done that in the past. This situation I think is a little bit different because this is just – there was no – some – a lack of sort of administrative paperwork done when a candidate was no longer running for office. But the point is that like – we have these campaign finance laws for a reason. They should be enforced. If they're messy, they should be cleaned up, because I do think that there's a public interest in knowing who's giving money to our elected
officials. Right. But I think we often hear when it comes to campaign finance issues that voters just do not care. I think we've seen this with a lot of politicians. But what does it mean that these laws exist, Barrett, and no one follows them really?
Well, look, in the Walt Blackman case, it's just about bitterness. They're still fighting an election from a couple of years ago. But that aside, you know, some of these laws, the laws are important. And, you know, I think Blackman just didn't really close out his campaign. You know, that is, I think, more administrative. Mm-hmm. But when you're an active – you have an active campaign and you're raising money, it is really important. Voters deserve the right to know who is giving to your campaign. It's not so much about the spending, I think, as who's giving.
And on top of that – a lot of these people are currently in office raising
money.
Right.
And so the fact that the laws in Arizona, if you're a legislator, unless you're up for election that year, you're not reporting like you are in Congress. We have to report every quarter. You're not saying who is giving you donations.
I mean, we've
given, there's already really loose rules when it comes to legislators that should not be that case.
We have given the lazy an opportunity to be lazy for an entire year. And then, you know, in January of the odd year, you know, all right, you got to start the even year, you've got to start filing. So you got a whole year to be lazy. And then, all right, you know, I got to pick up the pace a little bit. So I really do think, you know, some of these fines should be enforced, especially on current, you know, legislators or any candidate who's in office and not reporting.
Last word here, Tony.
Yeah. And this is simply a matter of turning in a piece of paper that says who gave you money and who spent. This is very basic. You know, this isn't people maybe spending more money than they're allowed to donating more money they're allowed to. But you don't know that stuff if people aren't actually turning in that paperwork.
Yeah.
And so this should be fixed.
This should be fixed. All right. We will leave it there. Democratic strategist Tony Connie and Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we hear about how to move metal from a blacksmith who's been at his craft for over 50 years. But first, the NCAA Men's Final Four gets underway this weekend in Indianapolis. There are estimates the basketball tournament generated more than $3 billion in legal bets. Earlier this year, the American Gaming Association forecast bettors would wage more than $1.5 billion on the Super Bowl, again, legally. Our next guest says even with the increase in the availability of legal sports betting and noted increases in people doing it, it's even more prevalent in our society than we think it is. Reporter Danny Funt has covered the sports betting boom for The Washington Post and other outlets. His latest book is called Everybody Loses: The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. When Funt spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, they started with whether we know how much the market has grown in terms of whether there are more people gambling on sports overall or the same number of people as before, but gambling more money or more people gambling more money.
There's good reason to think the answer is all of the above. More people, more money on more things. It's a conspicuously understudied area, though. There hasn't been a national study conducted by the federal government of gambling prevalence since 1999. And when I asked people why, whether it was lawmakers or people in the industry or researchers, Many of them speculate that it's by design, that the industry is resistant to studying things as basic as how much betting goes on and certainly how many people have betting problems, because the industry would face greater scrutiny and politicians would face criticism potentially for authorizing this. As Keith White, the former longtime head of the National Council on Problem Gambling, put it, they want to count the revenue. They don't want to count the bodies.
Well, how is it that this industry got so big and so powerful, so seemingly so quickly?
A huge piece of it was that they convinced the sports leagues to champion sports betting, which is surprising when you think of the fact that for a century, the leagues were the biggest opponents of gambling outside of Nevada, saying it was an evil that would destroy sports. That's something you heard commissioners saying barely a decade ago. What I found in my book was that as this case that eventually went to the Supreme Court to strike down that federal ban was being argued in appellate courts at the federal level, representatives of the gambling industry were meeting secretively with the leagues. In those meetings, the industry explained this would make so much money for the leagues, not just because of all the partnerships they would sign with gambling sponsors, but because of the indirect revenue they would get from their TV audience growing so much. So for the NFL, for example, the most popular league to bet on, in these meetings, they learned that the study suggested that between the direct revenue and the indirect revenue, if legalization were to take place across the country, the league would make more than $2 billion every year. And as multiple people put it, that was just too good to pass up.
Yeah, I would think that for any league, or you reference, you know, states looking to legalize this as a way to bring in revenue, I would imagine it would be awfully difficult to turn down that kind of potential revenue.
It would, particularly for, you know, the NFL just started to make so much money. They eventually got on board, but they were actually a little delayed. It was the NBA and Major League Baseball who were at the forefront of this 180. And it's noteworthy because last season, two players on the Cleveland Guardians were indicted for allegedly fixing specific pitches.
Well, does it seem as though there's any appetite to scale this back? I mean, you referenced the Guardians pitchers. There's, you know, a not insignificant scandal in the NBA. College basketball has had point shaving issues in the past. Does it seem as though now that the toothpaste is out of the tube, like, can you squeeze it back in somehow?
You can, because there's so much to determine short of prohibition, whether it's restrictions on ads, on the types of bets you can place that tend to lead people toward compulsive behavior, on industry practices that I learned so much about talking to people in the business who say these companies can target the most vulnerable customers and exploit them in pretty ruthless ways. All of that is grounds for more stringent regulation. As for what will trigger that, I give a lot of weight to what I heard from former Major League Commissioner Faye Vincent, who passed away a couple of years ago. I spoke with him shortly before his passing, and he said he doesn't think that the moral argument would win out, that people would grow shocked by the public health crisis that was unfolding or on how much money people are losing. He thought that the threat to the integrity of sports is what would move the needle.
I want to ask you about another aspect that you looked into for your book, which is sort of the information that we get as information consumers, whether or not we're placing wagers on games. And it seems as though the fact that sports gambling is legal and that there are so many agreements and deals between news organizations reporting informations and the sports books maybe has an impact on what kind of information we're seeing.
I devoted a whole chapter to sports media's embrace of gambling. For one, just because it's just as shocking as what has the 180 that the leagues did. But I also thought it was important because it could have a chilling effect on what sports journalists are covering. I heard from people who've worked at ESPN, at all sorts of prominent sports media outlets, that the enormous amount of money in advertising that's being spent in sports media is causing people to bite their tongues when they are considering covering something that could be embarrassing for the sports books or embarrassing for the leagues for doing business with the gambling industry. As one person put it, it's as if sports media is being bribed by all this advertising. And that, as a journalist, I find really concerning.
I wonder, as you were reporting this book and talking to more and more people, what surprised you the most?
Yeah, I would say two things in particular. One was just, I expected a lot of people in the industry who I talked to be very defensive. And I encountered some of that. But to hear those people say things are getting out of hand, where we shouldn't be allowed to be exploiting people in the way we are, whether it's with misleading ads or certain targeted marketing or the way that we don't intervene if we have a feeling someone has a gambling problem. I did not expect to hear that from people in the industry. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that really shocked me was there's this whole side of the business that caters to so-called VIP customers, people losing thousands of dollars every week and often much, much more than that. And, you know, as an occasional $10 or $20 bettor, I just had no idea what that's like. And the unbelievable privileges that those customers get, whether it's throwing out the first pitch in a Major League Baseball game or having your kids get to take batting practice on a big league field or play pickup basketball in an NBA court. It's also the most dangerous because you're using all those perks to egg on just a unbelievable pace of betting. And if a customer shows signs of, hey, maybe this is getting out of control, there's so much pressure, I learned, to look the other way. That I found so alarming in that whole side of the business. My jaw was open as I was hearing people tell me about it.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right, that is journalist Danny Funt. His new book is called Everybody Loses, The Tumultuous Rise of American Sports Gambling. Danny, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Drive south of the border and you'll start to see some different brands on the road next to you. Chinese cars, many of them electric vehicles, have become common in Mexico. From the Fronteras Desk in Hermosillo, Sonora, KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky reports on how the U.S. is responding and what it means for the future of EVs in Mexico.
A tattooed rideshare driver smokes a cigarette as he leans against the hood of his beige, pint-sized electric car.
Sí, es mucho el ahorro.
The savings are big, says Juan Navarro, who used to spend about $25 a day on gas before buying his BYD Dolphin Mini. He spends a fraction of that to charge the Chinese electric car. He's one of dozens of members of a meetup group of other Dolphin Mini owners. Like Navarro, most of them also bought the cars to drive around Hermosillo for apps like Uber. Today, a few are gathered at dusk in a parking lot, including Fabian Morales. Just 2 years ago, he became one of the first owners of the fully electric hatchbacks in Hermosillo. It's growing really quickly, Morales says. In just a few years, BYD cars have become a fixture on Mexican streets, like they have in countries across the globe, even as they're virtually banned in the U.S. In Hermosillo, just a few hours south of the Arizona border, a sleek, modern BYD dealership sells electric pickups, SUVs, and sedans at a lower price point than most of its competitors.
Chinese automakers have been really eager to find new markets.
Ilaria Matsoko is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says companies like BYD have been able to keep their prices low, partially because of government subsidies, but also because they're able to produce certain components like batteries in-house. Over the past 6 years or so, Matsoko says imported Chinese cars have been a big driver of Mexico's expanding EV infrastructure. The state of Sonora last year built its first public electric charging station to much fanfare in Hermosillo. Matsoko says car manufacturers from elsewhere have been unable or unwilling to keep up.
The U.S. is certainly not offering an alternative here.
But the U.S. has taken an interest in the rise of Chinese cars in Mexico. Officials fear Chinese investment in Mexico and the rest of Latin America has gotten too big. And in the U.S., officials have banned cars with connected Chinese tech over concerns they pose a national security risk by potentially transmitting data to the Chinese government. Matsoko says those points are likely to come up in the upcoming review of the USMCA trade agreement that binds the U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
Mexico has a very important relationship with the United States, and the United States has a really conflictual relationship with Chinese electric vehicles. And so I think that puts Mexico in a really awkward position.
As it faces pressure from the U.S. to reduce its economic relationship with China, Mexico did put a hefty tariff on Chinese cars starting at the beginning of this year. Jorge Guajardo is the former Mexican ambassador to China and says that the new tariff does more than just appease the U.S.
The auto sector is one of Mexico's largest employers, both the auto manufacturing as well as the auto part manufacturing. And none of these Chinese cars have Mexican-made auto parts. So I think we're putting a huge industry at risk by just letting them in.
Back at the Dolphin Mini Meetup, tariffs don't seem to be weighing too heavily on anyone's mind. Fernando Vargas has had his small EV for just a week. Like the others, he uses it to drive for rideshare apps. Vargas estimates he's making twice as much as he did with his gas car. A charge costs less than a full tank of gas and lasts for a few full days of work. At that rate, and as the price of gas rises globally, he and the others seem unfazed by the possibility of replacement parts getting more expensive because of Mexico's new tariff. There's agreement, too, that China is meeting a need that the U.S. seems to be failing to.
Y siento yo que están...
I feel like they're more advanced than the United States, says group member Navarro. So far, the group's biggest enemy hasn't been tariffs. It's been the roads themselves, says Fabian Morales. They're really cool and all, but they're not made for the streets of Hermosillo. The potholes are destroying my tires, Morales says with a laugh. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
To hear more on this story and all of Nina's reporting south of the border, you can head to our website, kjzz.org, and you're listening to the show. Good morning. It is a show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. We continue now with our ongoing series of character profiles by my co-host, Sam Dingman. It's a project we call The Analogs, stories about people who make things by hand and what those things tell us about those people.
We figure it's about 80, 90 years old.
Even though the technology is so rudimentary, you can have a lot more control.
It has lately, in the last 15 years, turned into more of a passion type of thing.
I needed an escape.
On a quiet side street in Tempe, behind a nondescript garage door, in a workshop stuffed with anvils, hammers, and steel bars, a white-haired man with a handlebar mustache lights a fire in a forging oven. He's wearing suspenders, jeans, work boots, and a brace on his wrist.
People have asked me to teach them how to make a knife, and I tell them, I'll teach you how to move metal. What you make out of it is immaterial.
This is Richard Connolly. He's originally from Tucson, but he's lived most of his life in the mountain town of Patagonia, Arizona. Elevation, 4,000 feet. Population, 804.
And that's where I started blacksmithing.
Richard's been a blacksmith for over 50 years. He started his career as an auto mechanic.
And in 1973, there was a huge gas shortage, and I got laid off from my job as a mechanic. So I was just looking for work, and this friend had some wagons to restore.
These wagons his friend was working on, they were from the 1800s, the kind horses pull. Richard found himself fascinated by how well they still worked, the sturdiness of the century-old wheel casings and hinges. He knew right away he was never going back to the auto shop.
I was not happy there. And once I got into blacksmithing, that changed.
Richard started learning how to move metal, heating it up to 2,000 degrees until it folds like molding clay, laying it on an anvil and using hammers to shape it into coat hooks, gates, and fireplace pokers. He met an older blacksmith who seemingly knew how to make anything.
He was 80 years old. So he'd take me over to his house at night, and we'd go to the shop and build. And he would stand there and show me what to do. The most important thing he taught me is how to swing a hammer.
Richard came to realize that what the old man was really showing him is that blacksmithing isn't about what you make. It's about how you make it. When you look down at the glowing orange metal on the anvil, don't try to picture what it's eventually going to become.
As I'm looking at it, I'm not thinking this is a digging bar or this is a piece of a gate. It's just something that's there, and I know what to do with it. And it's just the doing of it.
Before long, Richard opened his own blacksmith shop in Patagonia. He spent countless hours there, literally.
When I really get into work and doing everything else, the rest of the world just goes away. It's just me and the fire and the anvil. And it's peaceful. People don't think that swinging a hammer and hitting things would be peaceful, but it is. And I'll lose myself. I'll stand around at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and realize I've been here all day and I haven't eaten lunch and I haven't stopped and I don't know. And it's not a bad feeling at all.
One day, a corporate sales rep named David Goodman, who was vacationing in Patagonia, came into Richard's shop. David was staying in an Airbnb, and he'd bought a package that included a blacksmithing class with Richard. David tried to make a knife, and the blade came out crooked.
The product was terrible, but what I found is that I love the work of it. I love the activity of blacksmithing, and I knew that even if the products keep coming out terrible, I'm still going to love the physical work of it.
Richard made one thing particularly clear to David. Don't swing the hammer too hard.
One of the first things that I realized was counterintuitive is the harder you strike, the looser you have to hold the hammer. Because these anvils have maybe around 90% rebound sometimes. So the harder you strike, the harder it's going to bounce up. So if you grip it real hard in order to strike real hard, you're causing a lot of damage. And it was Richard who actually taught me how to work loose. It turned the blacksmithing activity into a mindfulness meditation.
Work loose. The phrase stuck with David, so much so that he eventually quit his corporate job and opened a blacksmithing shop of his own here in Tempe, the one on the quiet side street. It's called Iron Rhino Forge, and recently he invited Richard down from Patagonia to teach a workshop. Things have been a little rough in the blacksmith business.
Now, unfortunately, I did lose my shop about 4 years ago. I had been in that shop 22 years. But I was renting, and the people sold the property, so I had to leave. And I'm in the process now of finishing up a new shop and getting ready to set up and start over again. So actually, I've been out of work for the last 4 years, and it's not an easy thing to walk away from someone you love, someone, something, and see all my tools on pallets with tarps over them out in the rain. It's painful.
But even after 50 years, Richard can't wait to get the new shop up and running.
Oh, I think I got another 15, maybe 20 years in me.
In the meantime, Richard's happy to hang out at Iron Rhino with David. They love to fire up the forge and talk shop.
If you swing a hammer from like 2 feet down to the anvil, you get a certain amount of pressure. If you raise it up to 4 feet and drop it, it's a mathematical thing, you get 8 times the amount of force when it hits.
We're going to stand very close to the work, lift it, and drop it. It's not slamming down. We're not punching down hard. We're lifting and dropping, and lifting and dropping.
Okay, stand up straight. Don't lock your legs. Lift that hammer up.
To me, blacksmithing is very much a partnership with your tools and materials. You get intimate with your tools and materials. If the steel cools down a little bit and you're trying to make a hook, it doesn't bend the same way. You have to be you're getting feedback. If I drop my hammer in the steel and it gives me an outcome that's not what I wanted, the steel is saying, based on what you've given me, here's what I can give you. If you want something different, change what you give me and I'll give you something different as well. The question is, can you read what that looks like, the impact of the steel? This is also why mindfulness is so important. Sorry, I get really excited about this.
The blacksmith community that I've known over the years are thrilled to share what they know with someone who's interested. And it's easy to know someone who just is curious opposed to someone who's really interested. What's the difference? A look in their eyes. You can tell.
I struggle going to friends' houses and parties when there's nobody to talk about blacksmithing there. Like when you spend so much of your... My life used to be managing my ADHD in a corporate job in corporate sales. Now, most of my day is spent inside my hyper-focus, and when I have to step outside of that, it feels weird to realize that other people didn't just experience all that. That's because it's really intense. Living within your hyper-focus is insanely productive, but it's a very intense way to live.
I realized at some point in my career that what I've learned most out of many years of forge work is patience. Things don't happen instantly. You have to be willing to stick with it. And it's a lot of the time, I'm going to spend a week or two making one piece, but it's only a week or two.
I had an opportunity to work with a Japanese blacksmith, I think a 53rd generation blacksmith from Japan. That's 800 something years. And they're an old armor making family in Japan. And I asked him, what is the most fundamental of the skills in your craft? And he said, it's the heart to never stop what you're doing.
Does it feel like an identity to either of you?
Absolutely.
Whoosh, yes, I'd have to say so.
The Analogs is an ongoing series. To hear previous episodes, visit kjzz.org/analogs. All right, that's it for today's Friday edition of the show. We will be back with you on Monday morning, of course, with much more. Don't forget, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radio Heads, and you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at @kjzztheshow. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. You've been listening to the show's podcast. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at @kjzztheshow.